Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Born in Turkey to Iranian parents, Marjan Kamali spent her childhood in Turkey, Iran, Germany, Kenya, and she finally arrived in the United States. As a child of immigrants in the U.S., though, it was expected that she'd become a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. But instead, she followed her dreams. And she's now a best-selling writer. Her latest book is The Lion Women of Tehran. And first of all, Marjan, you lived in so many places before you were even 18 years old. How much of that do you remember?
I remember most of it. I don't remember Turkey, because I left when I was two. But I remember the Iran of pre-revolution. I remember Hamburg, Germany. I definitely remember Nairobi, Kenya. And I remember Iran post-revolution, which, you know, those two were almost different countries. But yeah, I do remember a lot.
I want to talk to you about all of that. But first, let's start with your grandmother. Mm. She was quite a woman.
Yes. My grandmother was one of the first full-time career women in Iran. She had four children, but she also had a career, which for her generation was something entirely new. She was very proud of her career.
What did she do?
She worked in administration, I believe, for an oil company. A lot of people in Iran of her generation basically worked for the government, for oil companies. But the fact that she got up every day, dressed up, wore her little pencil skirts, did her hair, did her makeup, and went off to work was revolutionary.
And that was in the 1940s.
Yes.
So even in the United States, you did not have that many career women.
No, but you had my grandmother in Iran.
So that had quite an impact on you, I would think, when you were a little girl.
It did. I was surrounded by strong women growing up, very strong, vocal women, almost to a fault occasionally, people who took no nonsense from anybody. And this was really refreshing and somewhat ironic in a society that is so patriarchal, where women supposedly have a more submissive role. But Iranian women behind the scenes to this day run the show, especially in most homes, but also beyond. Yes, it did affect me. It affected me to see my grandmother. It affected me to see her sisters all doing their best to sort of blaze their own trail.
Did your mother work
as
well?
Yes. My mother did. My mother was a teacher, and later on she did other things, but she was first and foremost a teacher. She loved to teach, and I think people who are teachers never stop teaching. To this day, she'll teach us a lesson or two just in our day-to-day lives.
And your dad was a diplomat.
My dad was a diplomat.
Which is the reason you were traveling so much.
Yes.
I want to look at the history of Iran a little bit, because, mm-hmm. of course, in today's world, we have a certain perception of it.
Yes.
Which is not necessarily the most positive, let's mm-hmm. be honest. Mm-hmm. But a lot goes back. You said in the 40s, your grandmother was working for an oil corporation. She wore pencil skirts and, I imagine, you know, dressed to the nines. But there was a coup in 1953. What happened with that and how did it change Iran?
The coup of 1953, in so many ways, is the origin story of what we see happening today. At that time, in 1953, you had Mohammad Reza Shah, the Shah that we know as the Shah, and he was a young guy. He was in his very early 20s. He didn't have that much power, not as much as he later did. And you had Prime Minister Mossadegh, who is often said to be democratically elected. He had big visions for Iran. He was a huge nationalist. And one of the things he wanted to do was to take ownership of the oil so that Iranians owned their oil again. You have to understand, at that time, the oil was run by British Petroleum, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which is BP of today. And Mossadegh's plans for ownership of oil did not sit well with the UK, which at that time ran a lot of the oil in Iran and was in charge. And It's so fascinating when you look at the history. The UK sort of campaigned to have the US help them out to overthrow Mossadegh. They didn't like what he was doing. Harry Truman said no, he wouldn't have anything to do with it. And President Eisenhower eventually caved and agreed to help. And it was due to the risk of losing control over the oil, but also because Iran had the potential to become a communist country. At that time, the northern part of Iran bordered what was then the Soviet Union. There was a huge, huge communist movement that was spreading, especially among the young in Iran. And a variety of forces sort of convinced Dwight Eisenhower that the U.S. should participate. And the coup happened on August 19th, 1953, abetted by the U.K. and the U.S. and also Iranians who were on board with this.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I think he fell into taking the foreign ministry exam and then he passed. And it was sort of one of those things where, how do you say no to this?
Marjan Kamali, the author of Lion Women of Tehran, talks about experiences her own father had as a diplomat for that country.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Marjan Kamali. She's the author of The Lion Women of Tehran.
Where was your father in all this?
At that time, my father would have been 15 years old. He wasn't in Tehran at the time. He was in Tabriz. But I spoke to my father in great detail about the coup of 1953 because my second novel, The Stationery Shop, it's a love story. It's about these two teenagers who fall in love and they're supposed to get married. But on the day that they're supposed to get their wedding certificate, the coup happens. So the coup is a backdrop in that story. And my father told me that the 1953 coup was the first sense of disillusionment of that generation because they had been working really hard for democracy and they had made such advances. But then overnight, everything was sort of destroyed for that nationalist movement. And I think they realized how little power they had. And there was a sense of disillusionment, a sense of, well, we can work and work and work for years to try and make this country better, to try and make it a democracy. But at the end of the day, these bigger powers can just sort of take over.
What drew your father to the diplomatic corps?
It wasn't his first choice. He loved to fly. He loved to fly planes. And my father actually came to the U.S. as a very young person in his very early 20s. He trained in Florida. He worked for Pan Am. And he was a jet pilot. That was his true love. But being a pilot, I suppose, was not considered, here we go again, as stable or as prestigious a profession, just like you mentioned in the opening that, you know, people are pressured to follow certain paths. I think he fell into taking the foreign ministry exam because a friend of his was taking it. And then he passed. And it was sort of one of those things where, how do you say no to this? It's so prestigious at that time, you know, it was considered a really big deal to work in the foreign ministry. And so he did pursue it. He gave up his flying, which he always, I think, missed deeply. He talked about airplanes for the rest of his life.
So he would have been in the diplomatic corps under the Shah.
Yes, under the Shah. That's why we moved so much. And then again, a little bit after the Shah. And then he was asked to retire early.
All right. Now, you spent your first very young years, what, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age in Iran under the Shah. I think our perception of that is because there was a monarchy, that there would have been a lot of class division within the country at that time. How did you experience it? I know you probably don't remember a lot, but just from what you know, what was it like?
Well, I was there as a very young child under the Shah in the 1970s. And after the 53 coup, which we talked about, that young Shah solidified his power because he now had the backing of the U.S. And for the rest of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Iran and the U.S. were best friends. There's the famous scene where Jimmy Carter raises a glass and toasts on New Year's Eve to Iran being the island of stability in the Middle East. And he and the Shah, you know, they were allies. So the Shah did a lot of things wrong, in my personal opinion. There was very little freedom of speech, freedom to dissent. Opposition was constantly quashed down. But what he did do right was he really increased the rights for women. And he sort of continued this path that his own father had begun, where he tried very hard to westernize the country. That has caused, to this day, a lot of conflict. People say the 1979 revolution was a backlash against the westernization of Iran. But what it meant day to day was if you were in the middle or upper middle class, as my family was in Tehran in the 1970s, you had a pretty good life. You had a lot of social freedoms. Women had a lot of freedom to dress however they wished, to work, to get educated, all of that. And I have to always say they still have the right to get educated, even after the Islamic Revolution, and they still have the right to work. That's one thing that they were not able to take away, and that women to this day make up the majority of university students in Iran. But we lived a pretty nice life in the 1970s, but the thing is that not everybody did. The ruler class did not benefit from the same economic sort of boom that the middle and upper middle classes did. And that created a wedge. And that led to resentment. And I think that's in part, a huge part of what led to the revolution of 79.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
We spent nights in the basement as the bombs fell. Every time we made it back upstairs, we knew that we were the lucky ones.
Author Marjan Kamali talks about surviving the Iranian Revolution.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Marjan Kamali, the author of The Lion Women of Tehran.
The revolution of 1979, I think a lot of people recall that. Jimmy Carter was president. Students took over the embassy and took a number of Americans hostage. And that was very controversial at the time here in the United States.
And in Iran as well. So the second time I lived in Iran was during that period. So I lived there as a child in the mid-70s, and then my family went back. Right after the revolution, all diplomats were asked to go back. And at that time, if you recall, there was this period where we didn't know which way the country would go. And a lot of people thought, now we're going to have a republic. No more king, no more monarchy. It's going to be a democracy. That's not how it played out. But
you were a little older then, so you
have
some memories of that.
Yes, I was older. Yeah. I do have memories. The hostage taking was incredibly controversial in Iran as well. The majority of Iranians did not agree with this. Imagine if a group of sort of radical students in the U.S. today commits an act. We may not necessarily agree with it. The majority of Iranians did not agree with it. They were mortified and embarrassed. But at that time, that young radical group of students became the group that solidified its power. And with the new regime, that's the direction the country ended up taking. But I was in Iran when the hostages were still there. And I remember on Christmas Day, it snowed in Tehran. And I remember we all looked out the window and everybody said, at least it's snowing for them on their Christmas. I hope they get to see that. Iranians en masse were not exactly fans of the hostage takers. They were, many of them, more aligned with the hostages and felt bad for them.
And certainly I would think the upper class was more aligned with the United States and wanted things to remain the same.
Yes. When the country changes so rapidly, so drastically, it's scary. It's scary to wake up every day and think, well, what rights are they going to take away today? What law have they changed today?
And what was the conversation in your home? Your father, obviously, as a diplomat, must have felt that his life was somewhat precarious.
Yes, but my father was, when you think about the word diplomat, he was the consummate diplomat. He was a very steady, even-keeled person. He knew the history of Iran. He knew all the pros and the cons of the Shah. He always took the long view. And that's the other thing that I'm hoping to show with my books, is that here we think of Iran post-1979 as though these past 46 years or however long it's been represent the history. But they represent a tiny blip in the history of a country that's been around for thousands of years. And my father sort of had that view. He knew we had governments before the current regime. Hopefully we'll have governments after this regime. He knew we had the Shah before that. We had other dynasties. He sort of looked at Iran more as a land with a history of literature and poetry and music and art. And most Iranians, I think, don't feel a huge affinity to their government because, at least in the 20th century and actually beyond, they haven't had very good governments. So there are very nationalistic people who adore their country and tolerate their government. And as I say in the Line Women of Tehran, there's a cycle of protests where they try to change it. Sometimes they succeed, but sometimes it doesn't go the way they thought it would.
You said your dad was asked to resign from his position. How did that affect your family?
It showed me at a very young age how precarious careers are. I didn't need that one incident to show me that. I'd lived through a revolution. I'd lived through a war, because another thing is that second segment when I was there in Iran is when the war with Iraq began. So I was there for the first year and a half of that war, which was an 8-year war, one of the bloodiest of the 20th century, which is saying a lot.
Were you personally affected by it?
Of course I was. We spent nights in the basement as the bombs fell. Every time we made it back upstairs, we knew that we were the lucky ones. Not everybody did. War is a terrible thing to experience. Very few people who have personally experienced it think it's a good solution to any conflict. I don't, personally. So by that time, I was well aware of how fragile systems are, how fragile freedom is, how fragile careers are. I knew that it really was important to build a foundation of stability in a new country, which is why so many immigrants, I think, go toward those professions that you mentioned, because there's a belief that they're a bit more stable and that the rug can't be pulled out from under you.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
I knew that the people I loved could be gone in an instant. I knew that I could be gone in an instant.
Author Marjan Kamali talks about growing up in a war-torn country.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is author Marjan Kamali. As an 8, 9, 10-year-old child, how frightened were you during the war?
I was very frightened. I knew that the people I loved could be gone in an instant. I knew that I could be gone in an instant. I would see the planes flying overhead. You know, we had to cover our windows in our home with aluminum foil so that Saddam Hussein's planes couldn't see the homes. That way we could keep our lights on. Otherwise, we'd have to have the lights out. Because a lot of the bombing happened at night. And by covering the window panes with aluminum, you sort of black them out. It's a very traumatic thing. And even if you move on, you live your life, you do wonderful things, it's still always a part of you. However, it's not something I talk about a lot.
I would imagine as well, you said that you lived a very privileged life mm-hmm. under the Shah. Mm-hmm. By this time, things had to change for your family a bit.
Oh, yes, yes. It was not just my family, so many families who lived a privileged life under the Shah. Then tables were turned. And I have to add, we were not as privileged as many. We were middle class, but you had the rich in Iran, the people who were living huge lives of luxury, and after the revolution, their land was taken away, their assets were taken away. It really was a revolution. It revolved the wheel of fortune. The rich became poor, the poor became rich. People had to leave their homes and their money behind. So there's also that lesson, I think, again, the impermanence of anything.
It must have been a difficult decision for your parents when they decided to leave.
It was difficult. I think for anybody who leaves their country, it's difficult, especially so many immigrants come to the U.S. for a better life, for economic freedom. But most Iranians who came to the U.S. came because of political reasons. They didn't come because they thought, well, there's a famine and now I can grow a business. They came because they were politically stifled and couldn't live anymore under that kind of a system. It's always difficult, but it's different generationally. I think the generation that leaves probably has the hardest time, and then their children usually adjust, and then their children's children are, hopefully, American.
Is this the first place where you came after?
Yeah.
How did life change for you when you arrived in the U.S.?
Well, here's the thing. Because I had come from war-torn, post-revolutionary Iran to basically elementary school in New York City, my kind teachers always assumed that I was going through culture shock. And you could argue in some ways, maybe, but honestly, no. Because the other thing I've learned from living in so many countries, both as a kid and as an adult, is even though the language that's spoken is different, even though the costumes, what people wear, for example, between the Iran I left and the U.S. I arrived to was different, even though the food may be different, at the core, people are the same. So when I left war-torn Iran and came to PS 144 in Forest Hills, Queens, New York, was it different? Yes. Was it the same? Absolutely. The teacher had a teacher's pet. There was still a mean girl on the playground who had her little lackeys around her. The human dynamics were exactly the same. And so my teachers, who, by the way, had a huge influence on my life and are part of the reason I'm a writer, they were worried that I had trouble adjusting. But people are people. Emotional dynamics are the same wherever you go. And people want the same things, really, wherever you go. That was clear.
And eventually, you grew up. And what did you do before you wrote? Because you said you wrote your first book, I think, when you were 42 years old?
Zigzaggy route to getting there. I'm sure you've interviewed so many authors. And once I was doing an interview, and the person told me when they interview male authors, often the line is a straight trajectory. And when they interview women, it's a very zigzaggy line. I did a lot of different things. I worked as a scientific editor. I went to business school. I got an MBA. I taught business writing at university. I was a stay-at-home mom for many years. I did all kinds of part-time jobs and volunteering. It felt as though it was impossible to claim being a writer as my career, because it felt like that's not something people do if they have a real job. And I can assure you now, with 3 published novels, 2 international bestsellers, it still feels like that.
And I do need to add, your novels have been translated into something like 30 different languages. So literally, you are a world-renowned writer. Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
They don't want war, and they don't want anarchy, and they don't want complete disaster. It's a tricky, tricky place that they're in.
Author Marjan Kamali talks about United States bombing Iran and the impact on her family left behind.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Marjan Kamali, the author of The Lion Women of Tehran. I want to go back, though, to Iran and your feelings about that, because my understanding is you were in the midst of writing The Lion Women of Tehran, your latest book, when you heard about an incident in Iran, and that was the death of Mahsa Amini after she was detained by the morality police, something that a lot of people recall because it was so horrifying. Let's refresh everybody's memory as to why she was taken custody and what happened to her.
She was a 22-year-old young woman, Kurdish Iranian. Her Kurdish name is Gina. She was arrested in Tehran for supposedly having improper hijab, and she died while in custody. Many think she was killed, and this became sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. It wasn't this one incident that felt unique. But it was exactly because it was the culmination of so much injustice that it sparked a movement where especially women and girls poured into the streets because they were so tired of having their lives dictated by these fundamentalist men, many of whom are very old now in the regime. And this movement just blew. You know, it was as though a spark was ignited and it spread across the country. It spread across the world, the Women Life Freedom Movement. I watched from afar as it was unfolding, and I was here in the U.S. and I was finishing The Lion Women of Tehran, and it helped me write the ending. So the ending of the book, no spoilers, but it's in part informed by real historical events. I think it was a symbol of this long struggle, this long, long struggle for justice and for freedom in Iran.
As you look back at how your life has evolved from being in Iran, a country that clearly you love to its core, and you've ended up here in the United States, is there any hope in your mind that Iran will ever return to what it could have been and move away from being a theocracy?
I have hope because I'm a magical thinker. So I have these outrageous fantasies of that happening in my lifetime. I do love Iran to its core. I love its culture. I think its people are incredibly talented and resilient. They have managed to maintain their integrity despite being oppressed. But I don't know. I really don't know. It's been a cycle, protests and then clamping down. And now it's gotten to the point where we've been burned so hard. I don't know if what follows could even be better. You know, you want to think that if the theocracy falls, what follows is a democracy. And that's what everybody hopes. But who knows? Who knows if that's what would happen? It could become worse. That's like in my worst nightmares.
How do you mean it could become worse?
Well, it could become anarchy. It could become the country gets splintered. I mean, hopefully not. Hopefully we don't see that day. But there isn't a good sort of example of overthrown regimes in that region, which were then followed by this beautiful democratic situation. So you just hope that that's not what happens. But I also know it's not for me to say. It isn't for me to say. I'm a member of the Iranian diaspora. I'm a writer. Obviously, I have an international readership for which I'm grateful. But it's not for me to decide that. It's for the Iranians in Iran to decide that and to pursue that. And I think sometimes those of us in the diaspora, we have this deeply protective feeling toward the people we left behind, but it's their lives, it's their country, it's their future. And I really think that any long-lasting good situation would happen from within.
When you heard that the United States had bombed Iran just a couple months ago, did you have a reaction to that? You must have.
Oh, yeah. I burst into tears. I wasn't celebrating the way some were. You know, there were some Iranians on social media in the diaspora who were cheering it on because they thought it would lead to regime change. I don't want that kind of a regime change at the cost of dead bodies everywhere. I don't feel like that's a viable solution, nor is it an ethical or moral way to have regime change. I was devastated. I was devastated, probably because of my own personal trauma of having been bombed and having lived through a war. So I get that my response is coming from an emotional place, but I certainly was mortified when that happened.
Are you in touch with anyone who's close to you still in that country?
Yeah, I still, you know, a lot of my family's left. They've come to the U.S. They're in different countries now, but I had a big family, so I still have aunts. I have an uncle. I have some cousins. I would message them during that time. It was very scary.
What do they tell you about the conditions for them today?
They're stuck. They're stuck between a rock and a hard place because they have this government which is not necessarily doing what's best for its people, to put it mildly. They don't want war, and they don't want anarchy, and they don't want complete disaster, catastrophe. It's a tricky, tricky place that they're in.
If they wanted to leave, could they?
Not necessarily. No one will take them. It's really not that easy to come to another country if you have an Iranian passport. Nobody wants you. Nobody wants you because they associate it with the government. And so, yeah, they're stuck.
Have you personally experienced any sort of bigotry because here in the United States because you're Iranian?
Yeah, all the time. It's better now, but when I was growing up, the thing with being Iranian is most Iranians assimilate. And when they came, they assimilated, especially in the 1980s. So they're not like other communities where it's like, oh, look, those are the Iranians over there. Like they assimilated. Most of them were the ones who came already westernized. It wasn't a big problem. But sometimes when people would find out that I'm Iranian, they would be so surprised and they would say, but you're so nice. That to me was hurtful because the assumption was that I wouldn't be nice and they were surprised. And I remember thinking, why wouldn't I be? But it just showed that in many people's minds, those two things were mutually exclusive.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
The government doesn't recognize us as Americans. We are forever Iranian to them.
Author Marjan Kamali reveals if it would be safe for her to return to Iran.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Marjan Kamali, the author of The Lion Women of Tehran. In the books that you write, I mean, you are very clearly writing from a perspective of history, although your characters are all fictitious. You write the realities of what a lot of people go through, especially women. You write about being incarcerated. You write about torture. With the controversy, I would imagine, within the country of Iran, of what you write, would it be safe for you to return to that country?
For most Americans of Iranian descent, it's not that safe because it's unpredictable. There's nothing I've done that I believe warrants it being unsafe for me. If anything, I'm like showing the beauties of that country. But most Iranian Americans feel vulnerable about going back because whenever you hear of an American detained in Iran, it's usually an Iranian American. The government doesn't recognize us as Americans. We are forever Iranian to them. And so we are the most vulnerable. We are the ones who get detained and sometimes used as pawns in international negotiations. So I'm not going to go for a while. Even though I would love to go, to be honest with you. And even though, again, as my aunt said to me, who are you? You're nobody. Of course you could go. So that was really a refreshing reminder. But, and I am really, believe me, there's nothing that would warrant me being scared. But that's the problem because they're so unpredictable. A lot of people are scared.
You've written now 3 books.
Mm-hmm.
All based on Iranian women. What's next? Are you going to continue to write about the women of Iran and those of and those who have that culture? Or do you want to reach out at any point and write about something else?
Well, every book I've written has as its main characters Iranian or Iranian American women, but I always have American characters, always. And all 3 books have taken place in the US and in Iran. I can't imagine writing a book that takes place in only one. Because to me, Iran and America are intertwined. They were besties and now they're enemies. But when you hate each other so much, there's usually something else beneath it. And having studied both countries, I know how similar they are in their polarization politically of their people, how similar they are in so many ways, actually, we could spend hours about that. But so the next book will take place in the U.S. and in Iran. as well, and one other country that I'm adding to the mix. And yeah, I'm writing it. You know, it's the way I cope. So when terrible things happen, people need to cope. And sometimes they might watch a TV show to sort of numb themselves, or drink, or eat, or exercise. I wish I could say my coping mechanism was exercise. It is not. But I just write. And by writing, I feel a peace that I don't feel when I'm not writing. So it's just, it's the same effect that alcohol would have, I suppose, on the brain. It just, you know, removes you from the present in some ways.
Marjan Kamali, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with author Marjan Kamali, whose book, The Lion Women of Tehran, is not a true story, but it is historical fiction. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Marjan and her experiences growing up in Iran, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.